Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, underwritten by the California Wellness Foundation. I'm Dr. Kim Mulvihill, reporter and Health Watch physician, CBS 5 TV, and your moderator for today. We also welcome our listeners on the radio. I'd like to have each of our panelists now say a few words and introduce themselves.
My name is Dr. Celeste Robb Nicholson. I'm an internist practicing at a large urban hospital in Boston, Massachusetts, a Massachusetts General Hospital. And I have a large general practice there and also help to edit a website providing information for patients and for doctors at the Mass General. The main reason I am here, though, tonight is through my work with the Harvard Women's Health Watch. I'm the founding editor and current editor-in-chief of the Harvard Women's Health Watch, which is an 8-page monthly health letter for women that circulates to about 230,000 to 250,000 women throughout the United States. We circulate to primarily college-educated women, and we try to provide articles with basic health information as well as cutting news briefs that help women to see what's ahead and what they might be interested in, as well as some question and answer sections in the letter. I think our overriding goal has been to empower women to make good decisions about their health care by giving them information that's practical and usable and at their level of need.
And what do you see as, I would say, the major obstacles facing women's health today?
When I thought about preparing that kind of answer for everyone, I thought I would just address it from the standpoint of the readership of the Women's Health Watch. So the needs as I see them from the constituency that I serve are going to be quite different from our other panelists. These women have a lot of access to health care and a lot of access to information. So I thought, when I thought about obstacles to health care for these women, I think there are two that interest me the most. One is there's a general lack of understanding about how to filter the enormous volume of health information that comes to women nowadays through the media. It's exploding on the internet, magazines, television, and I think sometimes it drowns out some of the very basic, simple health messages that women need to hear. It's hard to know without some tools what things to disregard, and what things to incorporate into one's health plan. But there are tools for evaluating that, and I think the more that women can learn about the tools for evaluating health news, the better off they'll be. The second is I think there's a general lack of research into change of behavior. We have a lot of great health information. The evidence-based knowledge about how to lead a healthy life and lead a healthy life for a long time is very simple. These are simple health messages that have to do with not smoking and a normal body weight and lots of exercise. But these are incredibly difficult things for women to accomplish. The change of behavior is something we don't understand very well, and we don't know whether there are gender-specific issues for women. And we also haven't thought very much about some larger public health approaches. One example that I wanted to raise is smoking. We raised the price of cigarettes. We had more information than almost any other health exposure about the effect of cigarettes on various cancers, cardiovascular disease, et cetera, and yet people were continuing to smoke. And then we suddenly just made the world smoke-free, at least in many major metropolitan areas in the United States. And suddenly you can't go to a restaurant, you can't go to a bar, you can't go to the theater, you can't even stand outside the theater when it's freezing cold and smoke a cigarette because it's really not the social norm anymore. And imagine if we could do that with obesity, which we know is one of the leading causes of morbidity in the United States right now. And yet, 65% of Americans are overweight, and the number is rising. So could we think outside the box about some kinds of global community public health efforts that would change the social norm around that in the way that we did for smoking that would provide for a healthier environment?
Well, on that note of global efforts, Dr. Nancy Padian, could you say a few words?
Sure. My name is Nancy Padian, and I'm an epidemiologist at UCSF. I direct a large research program called the Women's Global Health Imperative. Most of my research, in fact, all of it right now, has to do with preventing HIV and other sexually transmitted infections among women in the developing world. And most of my research is in Zimbabwe. I have a couple of studies in South Africa and in India. My work really centered, we just heard about empowerment, and I also think very deeply about empowerment in my research. And we have two themes that are prominent in how we approach empowerment. One is to give women the tools they need to be able to protect themselves. Because one issue, when we talked about social norms, and here in the U.S., I think we talk a lot about male condom negotiation, negotiating with your male partners for women to protect themselves against HIV. And where I work, in many situations, that is just not on the radar screen. It's not a question of how good your negotiation strategies are, your relationship with your partner. Women are not in an equal position. They do not have a say over who they have sex with, under what circumstances. Many times, it's survival sex. There's older partners. So we need to give women tools that they can use to protect themselves. So along those lines, we're looking at microbicides, which are like spermicides that are being tested now that women might be able to apply vaginally or in the cervix to protect themselves against sexually transmitted infections and HIV. I'm looking at diaphragms and at female condoms. But in addition to looking at ways to give women these tools to protect themselves, we're also more directly looking at ways to empower them. But I think you have to be very careful because people sort of use the word empowerment. It's a very politically good thing to say. So as researchers, we've had to think about, well, how can you really operationalize that in a meaningful way that you can actually measure it and make a change? And we're really focusing on economic empowerment, on ways to make young women economically independent so that they would rely less on older partners and be more in control over the circumstances under which they have sex. So we're looking at programs that involve microfinancing, income-generating projects, small loans. And the hypothesis, which although intuitively sounds like it should be right, in fact, there aren't good data to support it, that if you make young women economically independent, they will then be able to protect themselves against sexually transmitted infections and HIV. And it's a complicated story because where I work in India, the reverse can happen. When a woman has more economic power, it can actually put her more at risk. So it's a complicated story, and those are the kinds of issues that we're working on. I was also asked to talk a little bit about that's daunting, and I don't want the audience or the listeners to think that it's something that you can't tackle, because I think we can. I think we can chip away at it. And just as we heard, I think the issue is we need to do the rigorous research to figure out how to do that and break down these global goods into things where you can actually do meaningful research. Along the lines of obstacles that are hopefully easier to tackle, I would like to point out that one of the issues that we're having to deal with is sort of the confounding of political ideology and care and treatment and prevention for HIV. And a particular example of that I'd like to just point out is I don't know if you're familiar with the global gag rule. Some of you are shaking your head just very, very briefly. And Karen can really speak more eloquently about this than I can. It's the restriction on fundings from the U.S. for any kind of reproductive health care anyway, as long as the facility where that health care is occurring, if there's anything having to do with abortion, safe abortion, counseling, referrals, advocacy, research, and even this is even if abortion is legal in that country, there's still restrictions on U.S. funds, even keeping data on unsafe abortions, for which there's an incredible amount of morbidity associated with unsafe abortions. Well, because in many countries, reproductive health is given in one place. So people who are going for abortion care, for pregnancy, pregnancy, for even for perinatal visits, are also getting their HIV care. And they're also getting information about HIV prevention. And so the HIV community rose up in arms about this. And in 2003, the majority of money that the U.S. was putting into other countries for care and treatment for HIV was exempt from the global gag rule. So we didn't have this connection. But just recently, they snuck it back in November 18th. It is now, that promise has now been reneged upon. And I think this has incredible repercussions for health for women. Again, not just which would be associated with unsafe abortion or anything related to pregnancy, but it will directly affect our ability to give care and treatment for HIV and prevention messages as well. Along those lines, for the prevention dollars that are coming from USAID, I'm sure that you know that 60% of those prevention funds have to be used on abstinence-only campaigns. And again, that of course, abstinence works. You know, if you're not exposed, you're not going to get infected. But in situations where women do not have control over when they have sex and under what circumstances, it's a hollow message. And if that is where the bulk of your prevention money is going, then it's probably not going to have as big an effect on the epidemic as something that takes into account the position of women in culture and society.
Thank you, Nancy. Now, you obviously have a large interest in the global view of things. I was wondering if Karen could say a few words, a little bit more here at home.
So I'm Karen Mextrath. I'm full-time faculty at UCSF, primarily based at San Francisco General Hospital. I'm also the medical director of the Women's Community Clinic, which is a free reproductive health clinic for women in San Francisco. And I've spent the last 10 years working in public hospitals. I'm an obstetrician gynecologist. And I've spent the last 10 years working in public hospitals in California, initially at LA County and now at San Francisco General, and see a very different population than Celeste and than Nancy as well. The challenges that my patients face are primarily with health access. And the obtaining health care, finding people who will take them without insurance or with publicly funded insurance, navigating the myriad of programs that are available to women to help them get piecemeal care. They can get mammograms funded or they can get certain mental health care benefits. To be able to find what those programs are is extremely difficult for many of these women to navigate. They are not the population that are exposed to an overabundance of health information, like those who read the Harvard Women's Health Letter. They are women who have very little information about what their options are. We're starting with just exposing them to some of them and trying to get past language and cultural barriers for women to understand some of the things we do know about how we can improve their health. So when we talk about what the women that I see would be best served by and what kind of change, it's hard for me not to go to talk about payer systems and insurance in the United States. It's amazing to me that more people do not support a single-payer health system. We're not talking about salaried physicians, talking about removing enormous amounts of bureaucracy to be able to use that money to fund care for these women. We have many wonderful small programs like the Women's Community Clinic where I work, and we're training health volunteers that then go on to get advanced careers in health and take their exposure of working with these vulnerable and women with their special needs. They take that with them and often go into futures that are directed to that type of care. We have many small, wonderful programs, but they're all patchwork. Even the proposal now for businesses to be able to cover, businesses being required to cover all, or recover some health expenditures for all of their employees if they have 20 or more employees, is a wonderful step, but it really misses that many women are outside of the formal labor economy or not obtaining insurance through their direct employment. More women are insured as dependents and not insured at all. So I guess we all have very different populations and exposures to what women's health challenges to women's health are, and I think it will be interesting to...
Well, I think that's a good reason to take something that has value in all of these different areas. We keep talking about prevention, preventing disease. So let's take a moment to think about something like a vaccine to prevent cervical cancer. How do you see something like that fitting in all of these different areas? And Celeste, could you start?
I think it's incredibly important. I mean, I think it fits in very well. There is something now that we're experimenting with. It won't probably be ready till about, don't quote me on this, I think about 2008 was my sense that the cervical cancer vaccine will be really out in the... Is that your understanding about it as well?
I've been told maybe sooner, that maybe sooner. Within a year it could
really?
Be out there. But there are some hurdles in front of using it. So go ahead, let me have you.
Well, right now it's experimental. We have to find people who are willing to have it tested on them. I think we probably will find those people. I don't really see that many hurdles to a vaccine if we discover that it really works and is effective for women. Cervical cancer is one of those things that we have great ways of detecting it before it becomes cancer, but to eliminate all of the screening, to eliminate a lot of that risk for women right up front, I think is incredibly important and would resolve a number of health-related problems for women. So I think it's a very important step. I'm not as acquainted, and perhaps, I don't know, Karen, if you are, with the hurdles that are left.
Well, and when we talk about it for, first of all, cervical cancer is a disease of women who don't get pap smears. Women who even get an occasional pap smear, one every 3 to 5 years, are very unlikely to get cervical cancer. It's been practically eliminated in the United States, except for the women who are recent immigrants and women who don't get any pap smears. And these are women I see who walk in with advanced disease, but it is a very small population in this country. And the issue with the vaccine is that it's 3 shots, costs about, I believe, $300, and would require not decreasing other screening methods by our recommendation until we have years of post-introduction research. So you have to continue providing the same screening recommendations for pap smears and possibly HPV typing, which is now becoming one option, and then add a $300 per person, which... Is that the best use of that $300 for women?
So, Karen, you're saying that for the women who need it the most, they can't afford it.
Well, who will pay for it for them? And if those women even got a pap smear, that's the population who get cervical cancer in this country.
So just to comment on it from the African perspective, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, it is the most common form of cancer. I think... what I was going to say is one of the big issues is who will pay for this in the developing world.
I think where they need it.
Exactly. Another hurdle is, I think, a target group that's greatly in need of this, and I'm not sure if it would be true in the people you see as well, is adolescents. And there's a whole slew of sort of regulatory, rightly so, issues and different kinds of effectiveness. You have to look at different immunologic parameters and such to do it in teens. I think that's going to be essential before that it's taken up widespread in the developing world. One advantage of it, which would be fabulous, and I think this might be what you're getting at, is if in terms of distribution, you know, if that the infrastructure that would be necessary, if it ever were the case that a vaccine were so effective that you didn't need pap screen, and you didn't need screening and you didn't need follow-up visits, the idea that you could sort of go out into a rural area and have even 3 shots be effective is incredibly appealing, which is, of course, why everyone's so excited about the possibility of an HIV vaccine for many, many of the same reasons. It's an intervention that's relatively easy to distribute and monitor.
One of the other obstacles that's come up is the idea that we would ideally be vaccinating pre-adolescent young ladies in the hopes of preventing them from getting a sexually transmitted disease. And I've talked to some parents who've said, I wouldn't want my daughter to have that.
Can I
ask you seem stunned.
Why?
Because there's concern that they might be promoting unprotected sex or just sex in general amongst a young population.
Yeah.
It's an issue that a lot of people are uncomfortable talking about.
Well, that's certainly true, but that's just an information problem because there are many other sexually transmitted diseases. I mean, it's not preventing one is not going to deter people from thinking about abstinence or safe sex or those kinds of things. From my point of view, I think there's a big information gap and always has been around these sexual issues that makes
Absolutely.
This kind of treatment and prevention more complicated.
That's right.
I know I could comment on that. We do have lots of evidence that introducing birth control, pills, emergency contraception, condom use, things like that in a teen population does not increase sexual activity. In fact, what Nancy mentioned earlier about abstinence-only programs and education, they've been clearly shown to actually increase the chance that they have the same incidence of sexual activity.
It's delayed.
But they have a higher incidence of unprotected sex, undesired pregnancies, right. and sexually transmitted infections. So by not giving them the tools to prevent it, by giving them the tools, you're not increasing their exposure.
I think the point, the women who are your target audience, and maybe most of the people we know, but I think it's a question of, in terms of who's making funding decisions, I don't know that that's shared, and I think political ideology very much figures mm-hmm. into this, which mm-hmm. is why not only are they promoting abstinence, but there's cutting money for condom social marketing and condom promotion. I had a question that has always been, I found very curious, and that is, I think a lot of people don't know that cervical cancer is a sexually transmitted disease. So I'm not sure that, I think, would figure into information. In my experience, that's definitely been the case.
Absolutely. That's what I've encountered as well. People surprised yeah. at that information. And we have one question here. How practical is a vaccine for HPV, given the various types of the virus and the possibility of it evolving?
That's the virus that they are developing covers a very small range of the viral types, although they do try to cover the ones that are most likely to lead to cervical cancer. A small number of viral types lead to a higher percentage of cervical cancer, but not all of it. So it can't completely be preventative. And then there's the very rare types that aren't related to HPV, but primarily it's related to HPV.
Right. Here's an interesting question. Is there either overt or subtle bias that works against women, women patients in the way that doctors are trained today?
That's you guys. Bias that works against women patients.
I think it's changing. As an OBGYN, when I started, it was primarily men in the field, and now it's primarily women. So there's been a dramatic change in the past 15 years or so. And I do think there was a more paternalistic type of care that was offered in the past that's changed dramatically, but I don't think that's just in care for women or care for reproductive health or care by men physicians for women patients. I think that's also a demand by the population to be more involved with their care and understanding that that's a positive thing, and it's not that your doctor doesn't know what they're talking about if they ask you which you prefer. I think I would echo that,
that certainly when I trained as well, also in OB, that it was mostly men, and it has changed quite a bit. I can remember how it seemed foreign in the residency that I was pregnant. Now it's, you know, that's
now
the norm.
So if I'm a little short of breath, you know.
I would echo that, too. I think they're asking women physicians, so I think we tend to connect with women patients, and perhaps some of what that question is about comes more from the patient. I would almost want to ask the audience if they feel that, because I don't think that there are studies that really show that there's a lot of bias right now.
But it is interesting, speaking of studies, that, okay, if we look at what we learned from the Women's Health Initiative, and a lot of people said, why didn't we do a study like this earlier? Would someone like to speak to the question of women in research studies?
I can only speak with it with regard to their participation in clinical trials for HIV. And here it's actually not my work. It's work of two colleagues at UCSF, Monica Gandhi and Ruth Greenblatt, who've done an excellent review of women's participation in studies that look at various treatments for HIV. And although there is definitely, people are aware that women are underrepresented in these studies, and the Office of Women's Health is very much involved in trying to up the participation of women. Nevertheless, it's still really glaring. Fewer than 15%, I think, overall in trials of new age treatments are women. And very rarely are there enough women in any one of these studies to actually be able to do gender-specific analyses. And there's various eligibility criteria. In general, I think that there's a lack of sensitivity as to the criteria that you would have to have for these trials to be sure that women are well represented. And again, there's a movement underfoot, but there's a big gap.
And certainly times have changed. I think we used to believe that if it was good for a man, it would be good for a woman.
Exactly. And in fact, a very interesting point in this article is that the women are excluded not for reproductive health reasons, you know, for lactation or pregnancy, but because of normal laboratory values and various clinical manifestations of HIV disease that might be different by gender. They're out of the trial for reasons that have nothing to do with reproductive health.
Celeste.
I can't speak to the HIV situation in particular, but I did want to just say that things are moving in a good direction in terms of including women in research. As recently as 1977, women were basically banned. Women of reproductive age were banned from participating in any clinical trials in the United States. And in 1986, there was a recommendation that women be included. And then with the development of the Office of Women's Health Research, in 2000, a kind of recognition that women were finally getting included equally in many kinds of research, but gender-specific analysis. That means at the end, when you look at everyone, can you tease out differences between men and women in the outcome of the study. We're still lagging a little bit there, but we've come, in my lifetime, dramatic leaps towards at least recognizing, including women in studies, and beginning to try to do gender-specific analysis in a global way. There may be very specific things in HIV that you know about, but I did want to put a plug for that because I think it really shows how a few people who felt very strongly that this was a problem in trying to translate clinical research into something practical for women made a big difference in the way we conduct research nowadays in the United States. And I think we should all, women should be really proud of that.
Here's another question. What arguments would you offer to the health professionals, doctors, hospitals, pharmacists, who invoke the conscience clause to avoid providing legal reproductive health care? You know, one example is trying to get emergency contraception at a Walmart pharmacy.
It's rather timely for me. Yesterday, Susan Wood, who is the director of Women's Health, who resigned over the very politicized and non-scientific decisions about emergency contraception, gave our grand rounds yesterday, and then I was at a dinner honoring her last night. And I think many clinicians and people who've been aware of being able to use birth control pills and levonorgestrel hormones to prevent pregnancy as an emergency contraception were rather shocked at the kind of controversy it has faced. But the news media unfortunately contributes to that. There was a study that looked at all the news articles up through about 2002 and found that 45% of them confused emergency contraception with medical abortion, which emergency contraception has no effect on an established pregnancy. And I think that that confusion adds to it. And there are laws currently in place that have been proposed to at least require hospitals and pharmacists to offer them, and emergency rooms to offer it to sexual abuse victims. And there are many states who are actually refusing to do that. And it's quite amazing, but that's a difficult question of how
it
you respond to pharmacists refusing to provide it. I would say one over-the-counter status, of course, is an absolutely appropriate next step for emergency contraception that's been unanimously recommended by the FDA advisory panels on every level except the very top, which came down and said no. And the safety profile is indisputable, even in teens, and now there's specific data in teens, which was their particular question. The only possibility now is getting a dual status with under 17 being required to have a prescription. And, you know, how you do that is the question, but it certainly has been done. It's been done with other medications. But whether that's appropriate is just, I mean, to me that seems ridiculous. You're providing someone with a levonorgestrel that can prevent pregnancy, mm-hmm. and most people's goal is to prevent teen pregnancy. I mean, that even in people who are, or prevent unwanted teen pregnancies and decrease abortions, and the people who are opposing emergency contraception are standing in between are blocking what they're hoping to accomplish.
Another interesting question, sort of back to what we were previously talking about. How do you feel about the differences we are learning about treating men and women with regards to heart disease? Celeste, I'm sure you have some thoughts on that.
I feel it's great that we're learning. Well, so how I feel about the differences, I think, first of all, we are learning that there are differences. And I think that's good news. We don't understand biologically the reasons for the differences at this point. There are observed differences, particularly with respect to women developing heart disease later in life, and perhaps that being the entire explanation, but probably not, for the fact that they have poorer outcomes after cardiac catheterization, after MI, congestive heart failure, much, you know, more so than men who tend to have heart disease at a younger age. We don't really know quite why aspirin seems to be preventive in men, and it clearly is not in women, except for women over the age of 65, in terms of reducing heart disease risk. So one of the program plans through the Office of Women's Health Research going forward in 2005 is to do a lot more gender-based biologic research. And I think we will learn more about maybe things as basic as blood vessel reactivity and endothelial cells, which are the cells that line the insides of blood vessels, and their ability to go into spasm or not, or clotting factors that we don't really yet understand very well. So I think, hooray, let's do some gender-based research. We've observed these differences, but we really haven't gotten down to the level of understanding precisely what causes them.
I'd like to take a moment now to say a few words. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our topic today is women's health. Our guests are Celeste Robb Nicholson, editor-in-chief of Harvard Women's Health Watch, Nancy Padian, executive director, Women's Global Health Imperative, UCSF, and Karen Mextroth, director of Family Planning Services, UCSF Medical Center, and the Women's Community Clinic. Thank you all again for being here. Tell me, what do you think about obesity, one of the largest problems facing women and men today? Many people, there's a lot of discussion in the news about surgical treatments. But what do we know about spending the same effort, the same time, the same money on other ways of treating or preventing the problem? Anyone have any thoughts?
We don't know much about comparing those two things. It's part of what I meant when we were talking before about not really putting enough effort into learning how people change behavior. We tend to have a society, and I'm speaking again to the people with lots of access, who want a quick fix for something. They want the bypass procedure or the medication. There are certainly places for that kind of treatment for morbid obesity, but we don't want to face the fact that we all need to be getting exercise, and we need to be reducing the fats in our diet and reducing the calories, and movies like Super Size Me, I think, are really important things for helping us reformulate cultural norms. We in the United States have gotten used to huge servings of everything. And yet, people reach for something, and the number of patients who want to have a pill for this or who want to have liposuction, something that can be done to them to take the place of some very basic behavior changes. And we've seen how hard behavioral change is. So that's why I'm extremely high on the notion of public health efforts and a lot more in the way of research on what it is there anything specific about women that we should know that makes it hard for us to change behaviors?
Seems like we have kind of a continuum here from you have the population of women who have probably more possibility of changing I see women who have so many other stressors in their life that the idea of getting exercise and being able to afford to eat outside of McDonald's can be especially difficult. And then we have the level that Nancy's dealing with. It's mm-hmm. it's a very the type of challenges that face these populations in combating obesity are probably very different.
And I think the other issue is the priority. I don't mean at all to say that where I work, infectious diseases are the only priority or the only outcome. And clearly, these more chronic problems do affect women there. But in terms of just lifestyle and what they're having to deal with, it's not, at least among the women I work, I don't think it's a high priority. So I do think this is a very we should switch seats.
I did want to point out, and probably should have prefaced this with just bringing us together to understand that obesity leads to type 2 diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure, things that become chronic and are responsible for a huge burden of chronic disease in the United States. I mean, it is a big public health problem. It's not just a cosmetic problem or a something less than that. It's going to cost us a lot of money to take care of this problem that could be dealt with by individuals or by our society in a probably much less expensive and more healthful way.
Well, for example, could we do something where, what if an insurance company said, I will pay you to maintain a healthy weight and thereby avoid the dollars having to be spent down the road to treat health complications of obesity?
I think it's a great idea.
Actually, in my field, there is a whole area of research which we're only now getting involved with, which does involve conditional cash transfers for behavior change. And I think you can't do it in isolation, but in the proper context, I think it probably does have quite a bit of value. It doesn't always have to be cash. I mean, it depends on the context in which you're doing it, but I mean, certainly some sort of mechanism like that is very interesting and worth pursuing.
I'd say that one of the primary difficulties for the population I see would be culturally specific options for these women, mm-hmm. because when you live in a community where your diet is dictated by that community or your husband who wants specific food, it takes more than just a suggestion or a monetary incentive, I think, to be able to really make such dramatic change in a community and in a lifestyle.
Nancy, you spoke about the need for economic independence.
Yeah.
Does that begin with health or education?
That's a complicated issue. I mean, it's hard to separate it out. I think the issue of when you think about economic independence, it's a constellation of factors. And so, I mean, on the one hand, if you're thinking about an individual and that young woman's trajectory, I would say education first. However, she is living in the context where her mother could have had opportunities that would then affect her. So it's sort of hard to separate out which comes first. I think you really have to think about a package of factors that affect empowerment and economic independence, which includes both. I know that's a little bit of a fudge, but I do believe it.
Karen, any thoughts?
I don't know that I can add much to that.
Okay. Here's a rather specific question for us. Why are C-section delivery rates so high? Is it for the convenience of male doctors? Is vaginal delivery preferred from the female perspective? I think we can each answer this. Okay, please,
yeah.
Karen.
Yeah, directed toward the ends of the table there. C-section rates vary a lot. It's clearly been shown to be associated with your choice of clinician. So among physicians, some have higher rates than others. Some of that has to do with the population that they see. Other is style. Midwives have been shown to have lower rates of patients who eventually need C-sections. Obviously, they don't perform the C-sections, and birth class preparation, actually attempting a home birth. I mean, there's a lot of things that are associated with decreased C-sections. And there are some cultures, currently in Brazil, there's a population kind of the middle of the economic spectrum where it's considered a sign of higher socioeconomic status to obtain a C-section. So we have extremely high rates in some populations in Brazil. It in other countries, public hospitals perform primarily the C-sections and private hospitals are permitting more vaginal deliveries or the other way around. And so where you go for a delivery and who your provider is does have a definite effect on what the chance that you'll get a C-section is. From the patients I see many, you know, San Francisco is a place where we have a large population of women who are really trying to have more natural births. And we work closely with home birth midwives at San Francisco General. And I personally took a birth class with my first child, and as my husband, a pediatrician, and me, an OBGYN, we tried to stay under the radar there. But it was really interesting to see the type of information that women receive. And we got very balanced information of it's great to avoid it, but when you need it, it actually can be life-saving. And it's when women get that kind of information and form a relationship with their provider that they trust, I think is the ideal way to only get it when you need it. But certainly one avoiding it initially with current options of not being able to have what we call VBACs, vaginal birth after C-section, in many hospitals.
That has changed the circumstances. Yeah. Many women who had a C-section the first time may not have the same opportunity to have a vaginal birth afterwards.
In community hospitals.
So I think that probably has some impact on the changing rates. And then there's another thing that we haven't touched on yet. Many women are deciding they just don't want to go through labor. They don't want to have a vaginal birth. And so there are a lot of women who are going to their doctors saying, I don't want labor. I want to have a C-section. Can we pick the date?
There's also some misunderstanding of the protection of the pelvis, the idea that it would prevent incontinence and pelvic surgery and pelvic problems. And although vaginal delivery is generally associated with incontinence immediately after delivery, in older women, when it's actually a significant problem, there's no difference. And it's so I think some women think of it as preservation of something that's not really going to make much of a difference.
But it's interesting to have these discussions with patients and with their partners in terms of what is your goal. And if you are, if I'm talking to a woman who sees this as, well, it's just like plastic surgery. If I wanted to have a facelift and I was willing to accept the risk, that would be okay. So why can't we do that for the delivery of the baby? You know, it's an interesting topic.
We've had this discussion a lot in my among OBGYNs, of course, and my one concern is that there are so many risks, so many things that relate to C-section that are hard to cover. The risk of having what we call placenta accreta with the second, so placenta stuck in a C-section, the risk of hysterectomy with the future, needing surgery later that then is more difficult and more higher risk of organ injury. I mean, there's just so many risks that if I had a patient who I really felt like understood, I know OBGYNs who would choose that. So that's a clearly and well-informed patient, but they're few.
And I think that's the question. How do we know that we really have achieved informed consent?
I was interested in the tone of the question, which was, is it for the doctor's convenience? Which underscores for me still this general climate of mistrust that still exists between patients and doctors. And I think women do, and maybe this gets at one of the earlier questions, some women, not all women, but some women still do feel a sense of mistrust or not a strong relationship with their clinicians, reach out for information in a whole lot of different other areas because they feel they're not getting what they want from their clinician or maybe don't trust it. And we still have work to do in that area of the doctor-patient relationship and making that relationship stronger so that there's trust on both sides about the reasons for doing things.
I was just going to take this to another continent and a different radar screen, and that is, I mean, you bring up an incredibly complex issue about informed consent in general, and I think about that in terms of the research that I do in developing countries, and it's very, very difficult. We do quizzes to make sure that people understand, but it's I can't say that we're doing a stellar job. Much more work needs to be done on that. And when you think about, you're talking, what Celeste was talking about, trust between a patient and a provider, we have to deal with trust between a community and researchers, and many of those researchers are not from their country. And it's an ongoing challenge.
What role would you like to see the pharmaceutical industry play in women's health issues? Nancy, I'd like you to start on that one.
Big. I'm only recently been enlightened about this, I should say. And again, most of my work has to do with HIV prevention and care, but I think there's a tremendous role for pharmacists. There's a tremendous role for pharmacists in distribution. I mean, in many countries in where I work, women, for example, in Asia, I do work in India, I've done some work in Vietnam, in China, people go to their local pharmacist, and that's where they find out about healthcare, and it's an incredible way to disseminate information, and I think pharmacy has a huge niche to play there. And also in terms of making treatments available, I think we haven't exploited pharmacy. Well, I shouldn't use the word exploited. We haven't worked with our pharmaceutical and our colleagues enough in the field of HIV on a variety of levels.
Oh, last night, having been to a pharmacy and pharmaceutical dinner, which was celebrating and lamenting certain things about emergency contraception, I was really amazed to see the types of programs the pharmacists have often started in their communities. There's pharmacists in small towns in California who are trying to remain under the radar, who are really doing a lot to decrease teen pregnancy, who are working directly with providers, even as this pharmacist was talking about, working with churches and born-again churches to really improve communications about reproductive health for teens. They're providing, I know around here they provide many vaccines, which is somewhat controversial because no one else is getting the vaccines. But I think there's a role that even I wasn't quite so aware of what pharmacists can provide. I'm not talking pharmaceutical industries. I think I see the side. I deal a lot with contraception, and there are very few pharmaceutical companies who are willing to work on or provide contraception options. It's just a very small number of companies. And luckily, in the past 10 years, we've had a relative explosion with a few new methods, considering we had nothing for decades as new methods of contraception. And that's certainly been an improvement, but there's still so many companies that shy away from women's reproductive health.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Just to add something along those lines, in trying to engage the pharmaceutical industry in being involved in developing a microbicide, a product that women can use, I think has been very difficult. To just echo what Karen was saying, though, about the role in women's health. Now that we say this, I think it would have been very interesting, and maybe in a next forum. There is a whole program of women's health in the pharmacy school here, and I think it would have been interesting to have someone like that on the panel, and is worth pursuing in the future.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Celeste?
I have a slightly different take on it, although I agree with everything everyone has said. I would like to see pharmaceutical companies back off on their direct-to-consumer marketing. In the olden days, which is when I started into medical practice, when a drug was released, it came to the clinicians through drug representatives or through reading papers, academic papers, and it would specifically describe for us who the patients were who really needed that drug. And we looked at the studies, and we began to release it to our patients somewhat slowly. And there's a very good reason for this, because what many people don't understand is that when a drug goes through development and the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, says it's ready to go to the market, once it goes to the market, there's a lot of post-market analysis that takes place, because suddenly it's launched on a general population, and so the drug companies are still looking for adverse effects and measuring them for years after a drug has come out. So anyone who's on a drug recently released is part of the experimental group. That would just make sense. So you'd like to be sure that it's going to the people who really need to get it. But if it hits the television set or the magazine, the minute it comes out and the clinician is hearing about it just about the same time that the patient is, and the patient's demanding it, which on the one hand, it's great that she is reading and is interested in this. On the other hand, she may not be the right person for this medication. And so we see things happening like with Vioxx, which came out. It was unleashed on a very large population. We began to collect information about the people it shouldn't be given to, and as a result, it came completely off the market. I would love to see some sort of agreement that for the first 2 to 6 months, this would be very expensive for drug companies, but for a period of time that there would be, they would be limited in their advertising to give a medication an opportunity to get into the marketplace in a much more clinically responsible way. I don't know how possible that is, but it's an issue I think is very important.
Billions of dollars are spent on direct-to-consumer advertising. Right. I mean, think of what Bob Dole did for Viagra. Right. But also think about what he did for men who have erectile dysfunction. Right. Many people would say they're educating the public to talk about things that they might not otherwise talk about.
All of that's good stuff. Women are responsible for 2/3 of the dollars spent on pharmaceuticals in the United States. We are the target of all of that advertising. And we have insatiable interest in health. I think it's great. I think there's a lot of education around some of that. But there are responsible ways to educate women about new medications. And it's not to flash a picture of some much too young woman taking Fosamax, for example, who's not really ready for it, and heaven knows what will happen to her if she's taking it for 25 or 30 years if she starts too soon, but is demanding it sooner than she really needs it.
That maybe she's getting the medication ahead of the time when she would need it most.
Or possibly that it will do something to bone remodeling that she can't make up for at a later time in her life. So,
questions that we don't know
the answers to. Right.
So you're saying we're guinea pigs.
Well,
I didn't really say that. All right, so another question. In the education of male and female physicians these days in the U.S., how much women-specific perspectives are being taught? What remains left to do? Are new physicians still primarily male or 50-50 with newer, latest classes?
I believe it's about 50-50, 51-49.
Yeah, 51 women
to
49% men is what's the latest number I saw.
Slightly more women, and still there are some departments that tend to be attract more women and some that attract fewer. As far as women's perspectives in medical school, I'm involved in teaching medical students, and it is interesting that the reproductive health and reproductive choice is an elective. And I would say at UCSF, many of the medical students have more exposure to reproductive health information and classes, and it's incorporated into their basic second-year medical school classes. I hear repeatedly, though, from when I travel and from students who come to apply for our residency, that I actually just heard a couple weeks ago someone who in their medical school had an entire hour on the male orgasm and didn't mention the female orgasm. Now, this was at a different medical school, and someone raised her hand and said, when will we be talking about female orgasm? He said, oh, well, we really don't know much about that.
Was in medical school.
This was in medical school. She's a few years behind me. So it was probably closer to 5 years ago. So that's not that long ago.
We have a ways to go. There are centers of excellence in women's health all around the country. And I think, though we are far behind where we ought to be with educating medical students about women's health, we have made lots of strides, certainly in my own lifetime. The other thing that medical schools are spending a lot more time on nowadays is just training students in the doctor-patient relationship, which may be as important as the head knowledge about women's health issues is engaging with the patient, whether they're male or female, and if they're female, trying to understand from that woman's perspective what it is that she needs. I think we're doing a little bit of a better job nowadays training young physicians to do some of that. again, we can go further.
But I think in addition to gender differences, there's also an attempt to understand cultural differences
right.
as well and how that can impact
exactly.
on health,
yeah.
health care and information, whether a family is receptive to having a loved one be told a diagnosis or would they would prefer to have that individual not be told.
Yeah.
Are there gender differences in mental health? And what are they?
Oh, my. Well, that's a huge topic. Women suffer from depression twice as much as men. Women suffer from obsessive-compulsive disorders much more often than men. We don't know why. I can't speak to schizophrenia, but there are... So, yes, there are gender differences. I don't think we really understand the biological basis of them. We're hardly stepping into an era of understanding that most mental illness has a biological basis. So now figuring out what the gender differences are will be interesting. But statistically, we know that there are big differences in the experience of depression and women experience many mental illnesses much more frequently than men.
No other comments.
I agree.
Okay. In your experience, how receptive is the pharmaceutical industry to underwriting educational initiatives? And other than good public relations, what kinds of payback can they hope to achieve?
Do you want to go first?
I don't know the answer to the question. I mean, I don't have
anyone
more to say than I did before, really. Not
there are many pharmaceutical companies that are promoting huge programs for HIV/AIDS, both in terms of education and prevention. I imagine that the payback, one likes to believe, I mean, that if for some industries it actually is philanthropic. I think there are certain pharmaceutical industries that are known for their philanthropy. For others, maybe it's good publicity. Certainly it's not uniform, and I can't really generalize, but I mean there are some pharmaceutical industries that are relied on heavily with regard to HIV/AIDS.
What can we do to get a single-payer health program?
We were so close not that long ago. I don't know that there's many organizations that have enormous amounts of information on the website that I'm trying to think of the one that I was reading not long ago. I'm sorry, I don't remember the name of the organization. But there are a lot of grassroots way organizations that work for that, being involved in policy, educating people as to what it means. I think one of the biggest problems is the confusion about what it means. The argument against it is that, well, it would never go over because people want choice in healthcare and we don't want to wait in line for procedures. We want our good medical care. We don't want to have to give up to mediocre medical care. There's an abundance of evidence that none of that is true, that the countries that have single payer, not necessarily salaried physicians, get more doctor visits, more health care, the same number of advanced procedures, such as transplants, and spend half of the GNP or half of the amount of money per capita to obtain that same level of health care, and in many cases have better health outcomes of mortality and infant mortality and maternal and other mortalities. I think that understanding what it means is a big hurdle in being able to get widespread support. But in where to go next, I think I'd have to go to the policymakers to ask the questions.
Here's a question directed to Dr. Celeste Robb Nicholson. I'm an OBGYN. You're an internist. The conflict of counseling, the spin on the Women's Health Initiative study seems to be bipolar between these two specialties. How can we come to a united counseling front? And that goes very well with a recent question. What is your perspective on hormone replacement therapy and how, when it should be promoted for women?
I can't address whether there are differences because I'm not sure what the perspective is of the person who asked the question. Everyone's aware of the findings of the Women's Health Initiative, which was stopped early because we thought that starting women on Prempro, full dose, was going to reduce risk of heart attack and stroke, and we found that that was not true. And so we pulled people, women, off of it. I think a lot of people in the wake of that felt that we didn't really ask the right question, and that, in fact, the mean age of those women was 63. And so we were giving women at a much older age hormone replacement therapy, and that perhaps any prevention that might occur if women were given hormone replacement therapy at an earlier stage. So it's become a much more complicated question. Currently, the Kronos Foundation is funding a study to look at hormone therapy in younger women, ages 40 to 54, and those results will be coming out sometime next year or the following year. The reason this is important is that we have a lot of biological evidence that estrogen must in some way protect women. And, we have the observational evidence that women don't develop heart disease until about 10 years on average later than men. So that question will probably be answered in the next few years. In the meantime, I think that people are thinking that there is a place for hormone replacement therapy. And the general thought is that, or my general thought is, that the smallest amount that deals with one's symptoms is about the right amount. So that many physicians are giving lower doses of estrogen with progesterone for side effects, hot flashes, vaginal dryness, some of the problems of perimenopause and into menopause, and not feeling particularly badly about it, as long as a woman understands the breast cancer risk that she simply has to either decide is a problem for her or is not. So I think physicians are, there's kind of a paradigm shift now back a little bit towards using hormone replacement therapy, but in a very individualized way, and each time assessing the specific risks and benefits for each individual woman.
I think that's really the key point, making it an individualized approach. Yet it sounds as if you think, even though this was such bad news for PremPro, that other studies will be done.
Well, there were so many questions that weren't answered. One kind of estrogen was used. One dose of estrogen was used. There are many kinds of estrogen. Beta estradiol is not made from the urine of mares. It's more like the estradiol that exists in women before menopause. There are lower doses of each drug. There's a patch form that doesn't get metabolized through the liver. There are lots of different ways to take hormone therapy. None of those were studied in the Women's Health Initiative. And so now people are taking the step backwards. And if there's enough community will and money to study all of these things, I suspect that we will.
We have a lot more questions to answer, but unfortunately we have come to that time. Our program is now finished. I would like to thank Celeste Robb Nicholson, Nancy Padian, and Karen Mextruth for their discussion of women's health. We would also like to thank our underwriters, the California Wellness Foundation. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 101st year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.